Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. A recent study of America's 500 largest corporations, this from Russell Mokaber, found that, quote, 23% of them have been convicted of a major crime, that's a serious felony, or have paid more than $50,000 in penalties for serious misbehavior during the previous 10 years. In 1998, the FBI estimated robberies and burglaries at almost $4 billion. That's blue-collar crime, $4 billion. Cost of corporate crimes, $350 billion. More people die as a result of corporate crime than because of the actions of deranged killers or overwrought spouses. According to the Corporate Crime Reporter, the FBI reported that in 1998, 19,000 Americans were murdered at the hands of other people, but 56,000 people died from work-related diseases like black lung and asbestosis that were unreported by the FBI, and many times that number died from the silent violence of pollution, contaminated food, poison, hazardous consumer products, and hospital malpractice. Yet, Dan Gaynor with the Business and Media Institute, businessandmedia.org, would like us to think that crime is not a corporate thing. Dan, welcome to the program.
How are you doing today?
I'm fine. Why don't you want Americans to know that CEO criminals are doing more harm to America than blue-collar criminals?
Well, first of all, I'm not saying that there aren't any business criminals. That would be silly. But to paint, as entertainment media tends to do, to paint business people with the same brush and say that they're all bad, which is what we find in either our study of Academy Award-nominated movies or of television, well, that's just ridiculous. Even in the stats that you were just throwing out, you know, 3 out of 4 businesses operate entirely, you know, with the law, and you know, that doesn't even get into whether we're talking about some obscure regulation or anything.
No, I'm talking
like
about
that.
Felonies. We're talking about felonies.
But
23% of businesses have been convicted of felonies in the previous 10 years.
And again, that's businesses, that's not all businessmen. You know, the vast majority of American businessmen and women operate not only, you know, with the law, but ethically and morally. Businesses give billions upon billions of dollars in charity. They help communities. They provide jobs. A lot of the deaths that you were citing, the reality is the only way to stop a lot of this deaths would basically to stop all commerce. That, you know, in almost every business, there are unfortunate accidents and people do die. I mean, if we all stop doing anything, you know, everybody would just die of starvation.
Well, your argument here is that, quoting from your, I don't know if this is a press release or an article, but in part one, for American businessmen, prime time is crime time. You suggest, here it is. The BMI found, this is the Business and Media Institute, businessandmedia.org, found TV dramas overwhelmingly negative toward business by 4-1. Businessmen were portrayed as villains, not heroes. According to TV dramas, you're 21 times more likely to be kidnapped or murdered at the hands of a businessman than by the mob. Now, negative toward business, 4-1, and yet it seems that, let's see, we've got 56,000 people dying from crimes caused by businesses versus 19,000 people dying from crimes caused by other people, and that's just, you know, the overt ones, the ones that we know of, and it seems to me like you're probably 4-1 more likely to be hurt by a business than a person.
That's actually so not true. I mean, what you're trying to do is conflating the chance of walking down the street and having you know, murder or violent crime occurring, which is what I think, frankly, most people are concerned about when they're talking about crime, right, with the theoretical possibility that something a business does, you know, you might say, oh, okay, well, that we think that business is somehow polluting the environment, and then you're going to trace back and try to claim that it killed people.
Well, yeah. You've got the tobacco industry that admits now that they killed over 400,000 people last year. That's almost a 500,000 people that they intentionally, knowingly caused the death of. How can you say that these people are not criminals?
Well, I mean, every smoker I know and I know a fair number of people who smoke, they know that they take a risk. Every action we take in life, we take personal responsibility for. If you overeat today, and let's say you have one of those huge honking sandwiches, and you just pile up cholesterol in your body, and you do that every day, well, if you die early, is that the fault of the people who sell you the sandwich or the fault of the people who are putting in their bodies?
If I die early because the company that's selling me that huge honking sandwich decided to use trans fats rather than normal fats because they're 20% less expensive and didn't inform me that the trans fats double my risk of heart disease, and because you can't tell by the taste whether it's a trans fat or a normal fat, then, yeah, I'd say that company killed me.
And I would say that's a ridiculous hyperbole, because they're not doing it. If they obey the law of the land, the FDA rules, et cetera, then you're trying to hold them to a separate standard beyond what the rules that they're supposed to obey.
Well, I'm suggesting that they actually go out and influence the law of the land. They're buying off our politicians left and right. The Republican Party is basically an extension of the Chamber of Commerce nowadays.
I
would argue that the Democratic Party, to a large extent, is as well.
Yeah, I mean, but being an extension of the Chamber of Commerce, what's that old expression, what's good for business is good for America?
This brings us back to the point you made earlier. We're talking with Dan Gaynor. He's businessmedia.org. You said that companies provide us with jobs. I don't know of any companies that provide jobs. To the best of my knowledge, what companies do, and I've, the seven businesses that I've run in my life and a couple hundred people I've employed over the years, I always hired people to do work for me so that I could make a profit off their labor.
And you provided them a job in the process?
No, I didn't provide them a job. I hired them.
Yeah.
You don't get it. This phrase, provide jobs, which became popular starting with the Reagan administration and has kind of taken over the lexicon in America, distorts the reality. It used to be understood that employers were actually using employees. They were using the labor of employees, marking that up and making a profit from it. If I'm working for somebody, then in all probability, they're earning more from my labor than I'm costing them. And if I hire somebody, I'm going to hope that I earn more from their labor than they're costing me. So you could argue if I'm hiring somebody, I'm not providing them with a job. I am extracting from them their labor so that I can mark it up and make a profit on it.
But you're also taking all the risk. You are paying them. You are providing the structure that they can do whatever they're supposed to do, whether you're hiring an artist or hiring a writer or hiring someone to do radio.
Well, actually, if I create a C corporation, I'm not taking all the risk. I'm taking none of the risk because I can walk away from it.
But you still have to provide initial capital. You have to still provide the business structure. You still have to, whether it's physical plant or, capital expenses or anything like that.
Right, but does that make me any morally superior, any better morally or in terms of the benefits to our culture than the people who are doing the work? I don't think so.
It doesn't make you a bad guy. Which is the way TV and movies are.
Well, I would agree with that it doesn't make me a bad guy. I mean, as I said, I've started and run seven, I've run seven businesses in my life. I started and run seven businesses. But the reality is, if you look at the Fortune 500, you've got about a quarter of them convicted of felonies in the last 10 years. I mean, corporate crime in the United States costs hundreds of billions of dollars a year, whereas actual crime by persons, stick them up in the 7-Eleven, is only $4 billion a year. We're talking about a ratio of almost 100 to 1.
Well, but again, if you were to ask any of your listeners which they're more concerned about, do they want to worry about whether they're going to be safe in their home, someone breaking into their home, because that's an intangible cost.
But see, I would say that that's because of the exact thing that you're decrying, which is that our media has made us more afraid of the risks, the human risks out there that really aren't all that great. You talk about people, what are you afraid of? I'm afraid of having my house broken into, but the fact of the matter is most people never have their houses broken into. On the other hand, one out of every three people in America at some point in their lives is going to get cancer, and probably at least half of those cancers can be traced back to corporate activity in some way.
If you live in a home, the risk, the high end and low end risk, if someone breaks into your home, you risk everything in your life, all the possessions you have, your family, your children.
And the odds are much, much lower of that happening than of my getting cancer as a consequence of something put into the environment by a corporate criminal.
Again, the consequences of, because so much of it is complex. What is legal today under FDA rules or under EPA rules then becomes illegal tomorrow as we learn new things. So you're out trying to, you keep moving the finish line for a lot of companies, where the company says or does something that is perfectly legitimate today, and then tomorrow, then everybody wants to go after them and says, well, that, you know, what you did was wrong.
But what you'd like is for Hollywood to stop portraying businessmen as criminals.
No, actually, what I'd like is Hollywood to portray businessmen as both good guys and bad guys. When you look at all the top Academy Award nominee movies, and only one character, that's the Paul Giamatti character in Cinderella Man, is out portrayed as ethical and successful in business out of 70 different people, then there's something wrong with that.
Okay. Dan Gaynor, businessandmedia.org. Interesting point. You're the director of the Business and Media Institute. Dan, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you.
16 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program. The pill that will help you escape the matrix.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Shake it up. Shake it up. Shake it up.
And welcome back. Speaking from behind the good old working class stainless steel microphone here in the People's Republic of Little Beirut, as Bush Sr. calls Portland, Oregon. Tom Hartman here with you. 21 minutes past the hour. RJF7R in the chat room says, if only we had a three strikes law for corporations. Yeah, what a good idea. We actually did at one time in this country. In fact, from the founding of this country until the beginning of the, what is often referred to as the robber baron era, the 1880s, from the founding of this country up until that time, a corporation had to, in every state of the union, a corporation had to list as its primary purpose for existence to serve the public good, as its secondary purpose for existence, you know, whatever it was going to do, run a railroad, make matchboxes, whatever. It could not live longer than the lifespan of a human being, because the founders did not want to see landed aristocracies essentially emerge. So if a person dies and his possessions or her possessions get probated, they go through an estate tax, then a corporation should not live longer than a person, so that people cannot use the corporate form as a way of infinitely accumulating massive amounts of wealth. So up until the 1880s in the United States, in fact, to the 1890s in a lot of states, in every state of the union, a corporation could not live for more than 20, 30, or 40 years, depending on the state. At the end of that period of time, it had to be dissolved, its assets distributed out, and then you could start all over again. But there was, you know, an analysis of it. Because corporations, up until that point in time, were required to serve the public good first, every secretary of state was required every year to check out all the corporations in the state, and if they weren't serving the public good, dissolve them. And thousands, the average was around 2,000 a year, thousands of corporations during the period from the founding of this country in the 1770s all the way up until the late 1800s, thousands of companies every year were given the death sentence. That's it. You can't do business anymore. Sorry, you're not serving the public good. I mean, this is not rocket science. And we really need to go back to this. Corporations didn't have rights as persons. In 1886, the Santa Clara County decision, the actual decision doesn't say the corporations have rights, but the clerk of the court wrote that in the head note, which has no legal status. And the Supreme Court has been quoting it ever since. The corporations have the rights of persons. This is wrong. Ronald in Bennington, Vermont. Hey, Ronald, what's up?
Hi, Tom. How are you?
I'm great, but I'll get better. What's up?
I'm calling because your guest said something to the effect that he's sure any of your listeners would agree that they're more fearful of blue-collar crime than white-collar crime with corporations. Mm-hmm. That's just not true. I'm a listener, and I fear white-collar crime from corporations more. I know people personally who has got cancer and stuff from working in plants. I know no one that's been a victim of crime, street crime.
Yeah, people who have lost their pensions because the company decided to change the rules in midstream or decided to declare bankruptcy right after the CEO put $400 million bucks in his back pocket. I mean, Yeah, it just goes on and on and on. Good one, Ron.
Also, I don't know what he means by the media. I mean, I think they're skewed towards corporations.
I agree. I agree. He was talking about movies, I guess, Academy Award-winning movies. So it might actually reflect the bias of the, if there is a bias being reflected there, of the people who are voting in the Academy, but that's a whole different thing.
Right.
Ronald, thanks for the call. I appreciate it. Good to hear from you. Timothy in Auburn, Washington. Hey, Timothy, welcome to the program.
Well, hello. I do agree with what you said just a few minutes ago, that this notion that humans are here for the benefit of corporations is entirely wrong. My father has asbestos and has cancer because of it.
You're talking about mesothelioma.
Yes, and that was a known. Now, to add to that story, he's getting treated in an alternative method by technologies that have been around for a while that have been kept off the market by, once again, pharmaceuticals. Now, he's been alive for 3 years, and they didn't give him much of a chance.
Yeah, this.
So, once again, somebody is making money off of the chemotherapy. I believe it was about $120,000 before he quit it.
Wow.
And what he's doing is, you know, maybe by the time it's all said and done, maybe 7 or 8.
Yeah. My father also died just a few months ago of mesothelioma. And when he was first diagnosed with it, he was given 6 months to live. I went on the web and started looking around and found that curcumin, the yellow dye in curry, is being used for that in India, and it has been used for hundreds of years. And so Dad started taking curcumin, and they gave him literally 3 to 6 months to live, and he lived for 5 years. So anyhow, there's a tip for you, Timothy.
Thank you.
I'm sorry to hear about your father. Go ahead.
Well, he's doing well, and that's
good.
Because we have found. But the thing that I find very upsetting is that this technology has been purposely kept off the market, and I don't understand that part of it, that if you test it and if you can prove fairly that it does work, then it shouldn't be a threat to anybody. It should be promoted, or it at least should be studied and looked at. Instead,
That's really another whole realm is how corporations use lobbying power and influence with regulatory agencies to increase profits rather than serve the public good.
And that's on both sides.
Yeah.
That was allowing the asbestos and now not allowing the treatment for it.
That's right. That's right. Good point, Timothy. It was in 1934 that the Journal of the AMA first published. It was the first published study showing that asbestos caused mesothelioma. And I'm guessing both of our fathers were exposed to it long after that. 27 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, Truth and Common Sense in Broadcasting. For a change.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
Dreaming of a democratic America, a truly democratic America. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Our program today brought to you by Small Dog Electronics, 1-800-511-MAX, 511-MACS, smalldog.com. And speaking of, by the way, at the top of the next hour, first hour of the next hour, we're going to have Pat Buchanan on. He has a new book out in which he is very, very concerned that America is going to turn into, he's actually suggesting that Mexico has a plan to take back 7 states. So we'll be asking him, are you paranoid, or is there something here that we're missing, or, what's going on here? This is very strange. That should be an interesting conversation. That'll be coming up at the top of the next hour. We were talking about corporate criminals, disaster profiteers. This is from CorpWatch. A new study, disaster profiteers have made millions while local companies and laborers in New Orleans. Louise and I watched the HBO special last night on Hurricane Katrina. Man, that was painful. We're going to watch the rest of it tonight. In the wake of this, this is the first anniversary of Hurricane Katrina, more or less. Disaster profiteers have made millions while local companies and laborers in New Orleans and the rest of the devastated Gulf Coast region are systematically getting the short end of the stick. CorpWatch did an analysis of FEMA's own records and found that fully 90% of the first wave of the post-Katrina reconstruction contracts awarded, including some of the biggest OBIG contracts to date, went to companies from outside the three worst affected states. You get this? They're going to companies that are not in the area that was hit. So where's the money going to end up? Outside the area that was hit. This is the same thing they're doing in Iraq. 90% of the contracts are going outside. CorpWatch report also exposes abusive contracting charge pyramids, where the companies doing the actual reconstruction work only get a tiny fraction of the taxpayer money. For example, Ashbrit got a $500 million contract for debris removal. That's $23 a cubic yard for removing debris after Hurricane Katrina, according to NBC News investigation. Ashbrit, which was paid by you and me, $23 a cubic yard, then hires C&B Enterprises and pays them $9 per cubic yard. C&B Enterprises hires Amley Transportation and pays them $8 per cubic yard. Amley hires Chris Hessler Incorporated, who receives $7 per cubic yard. Hessler then hires a guy by the name of Les Nerdlinger, a debris hauler from New Jersey, and pays him $3 a cubic yard to go down to New Orleans and clean up the mess. So you and I pay Ashbrit $23 a cubic yard, and the guy actually doing the work is making $3 a cubic yard. This is twisted. This is so weird. As the report says, a familiar and disturbing cast of characters, many of the same disaster profiteers and government agencies that mishandled the reconstruction of Afghanistan and Iraq are responsible for the failure of reconstruction of the Gulf Coast region. The Army Corps, Bechtel, Halliburton, using the same contract vehicles in the Gulf Coast as they did in Afghanistan and Iraq. Amazing. Amazing. But white-collar crime, nothing to worry about. Gary in Richmond, Virginia. Hey, Gary, what's on your mind today?
You know, I appreciate the topic you're talking about. I think the reason most of us don't think about it is it happens so often and at such usually indistinguishable amounts and so forth. It's like, you know, somebody picking, you know, the change out of your pocket every time you turn around.
Yeah, that
and that's the problem, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. When it all totals up, and when you really start looking at it in its proper perspective, it's a huge significance, and yet we get wallowed down about the criminal that rips off the drugstore or something, and
right.
That's bad and wrong, but the proportions, you know, are just incredible.
Yeah,
thanks
I would
for
say.
Bringing it up.
Sure, you're welcome, Gary. Thanks for the call. $11,000 more or less per year is what Americans pay for health insurance. Those Americans who have health insurance, between the amount that you're paying for the premiums, the amount that your employer is paying for the premiums, which is money you could have had otherwise, and the amount that you're paying in taxes to cover, you know, everything that's not covered, it works out about $11,000, which is twice what any other country in the world pays for health care. Well, where's the other half of that money going, the other half of that trillions of dollars? It's going into the pockets of what I would submit to you are corporate criminals, people who have gamed the system to get these multi-million and in one case $1 billion annual salaries, pulling money out, you know, sucking money out. Bill Frist's daddy is one of the richest men in America because of the health care scam. He's worth $3 billion. Sid in Flagstaff, Arizona on the line. Hey, Sid, what's up?
Hey, Tom, how are you doing today?
I am great, but I'll get better, Sid. How about you?
I'll tell you what, I'm sitting here in Flagstaff, Arizona. I'm looking at all these just beautiful black-eyed Susan flowers juxtaposed against all this these beautiful conifers up here. It's just absolutely gorgeous.
It is pretty country.
Just a comment. Your guest was talking about how corporate America donates so much money to charities.
Yes.
Here's a comment. I work for a fairly large trucking company, and we specialize in hauling food products, a refrigerated line.
Mm-hmm.
We do a great deal of loads for Walmart. Now, there's a tremendous amount of Walmart distribution centers, and there's hundreds of trucks there that are just jockeying around sort of like flies on a cow patty.
Okay.
Well, Walmart charges a unloading fee to unload our trucks. Now, this is Walmart-paid employees unloading Walmart products.
So the employees are paying an unloading fee?
Right. Now, our company has to pay an unloading fee to have Walmart's employees unload Walmart products.
Right.
So, I thought, well, geez, I wonder where this money's going. So I started asking around, and I found out that they do this. They take this money, and they donate it to the Children's Miracle Network, which is great. That's great. I'm all about helping, crippled kids.
Right.
But the thing is they're forcing us to make this donation.
Right. It's not coming out. I guarantee it's not coming out of the bottom line of the Walton family. I mean, they're the funders of this thing to call the inheritance tax the death tax. I mean, the Walton family walked away with $8 billion last year in dividends, you know, in money in walking around change.
But here's the problem. They're donating our money. They're forcing us to make a donation and then donating that money in Walmart's name.
So they're taking credit for the donation.
They're taking credit for the donation. They're forcing us to pay this fee, which, of course, we have to pay us back on to the supplier, to General Mills or whoever.
Yeah, well.
Surprise.
Yeah. Their prices, you know, so that means that we have to pay more for our Cheerios because Walmart is forcing us to make this donation in their name.
Amazing. Sid, thanks.
Isn't that weird?
It's unfortunate, but it's not unexpected.
And my last comment is vote Republican because it's easier than thinking.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Hey,
appreciate it. Good to hear from you. I saw a bumper. Did I see it or did somebody call and talk about it? It might have been Roy in New Mexico was talking about. Sometimes you kind of mix these things up in your brain. You see so many cool bumper stickers, and we've got a bunch of them on the wall here in the studio. People send them to us all the time that said, I used to like the Republican Party before they all went nuts or before they all went crazy. I think that was from Roy in Rio Rancho. Yeah, Carl in Atlanta, Georgia. Hey, Carl, what's on your mind today?
Hey, I was just listening to you talking about the laws that we used to have in the United States before the robber baron era, which it seems like we're in another robber baron.
We are, very much. History is repeating itself.
The one of the things that worried me about it, though, you're talking about how the Secretary of State would examine the corporations and decide if they were working in the public good, and I was kind of wondering about what if there was a company that was selling a product that Secretary of State didn't necessarily approve of, wondering if there would be, I guess there must have been some kind of controls to keep them from using the personal or...
We can't, you know, over-idealize the past. The fact of the matter is we have corrupt secretaries of state now. I mean, look, Ken Blackwell, I'm sure we had corrupt secretaries of state in 1840. It's just, you know, that's life in the big city. But the reality is that back in the 1840s, an average of 2,000 companies a year got shut down because they were engaging in what were considered by the secretaries of state in particular states, usually in response to consumer or legislative pressure, considered to be unethical or inappropriate or illegal business practices. So,
and one other thing you made me think of when you're talking about those contracts in New Orleans, I have been involved in and some of that kind of work, and while it is ridiculous what you're talking about, the $23 an hour and the $3 an hour, but actually now a lot of those contracts, that original Ashbrook contract might have included the processing and disposal of this debris as well as just the hauling it there. I mean, there's no doubt the man who was hauling it should have got more money for doing it.
Yeah, but this, according to CorpWatch, this didn't. This is just simply, you know, five companies in a row sucking money off the top of this thing. Now, you know, I didn't do the research, so it may be that you're right. We should probably get somebody from CorpWatch on to talk about it. But it's a tragic, frankly, commentary on what's going on. I think just the fact that they're hiring companies that are not in the state. I think that, you know, if you're going to rebuild New Orleans, you should hire companies from New Orleans. If you're going to rebuild Iraq, you should hire Iraqis to do it. It worked. This is how the Marshall Plan worked with Germany, and it worked really well. You know, we're going to rebuild Europe by giving money to the local companies so that not only do they do the rebuilding, but they're also building an economic infrastructure as well because the companies themselves are growing. 45 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Telling the truth that the multinational corporations aren't all that excited that you know. Tom Hartman here with you. 9.5 minutes before the hour. 1-866-440-8466. Our telephone number, 866-440-THOM. And Jim in Mobile, Alabama. Hey, Jim, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom. I was on that assignment. I drive an overload refrigerated truck carrier, and I volunteered the day after Katrina, and I was assigned to DMORT, which is Disaster Mortuary Operational Response Team, and we were in charge of recovering the bodies.
Whoa.
They had a, about a week after we were there, they set up a little food tent for us, and it was run by 20 local people that had worked, that had a catering company in Biloxi. Well, about 2 weeks later, they did away with them. They moved in another catering company that was out of Houston, Texas, and come to find out, it was a subsidiary of Halliburton.
Oh, man.
Now, those people that would live there, they stayed in their cars because a lot of them didn't have houses or anything to live in. They lived in their car.
And now they don't even have a job, because keep that out, please. Jim, thanks a lot for the call, but we just can't allow that kind of language on air. Maureen in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Maureen.
Hi, Tom. First, I wanted to thank you for being such a great teacher for all of us and really serving as a mentor. I know for myself that's been a fact. I had the opportunity to go see and hear Maria Cantwell speak at a fundraiser last night that was held in Ballard.
Mm-hmm.
And this was my first time to see her in person. And I just wanted to put this out there because I frankly didn't have, not a negative opinion, but sort of an ambivalent opinion about her. And many of my friends and other people that I've talked to have. And I was
Was she still defending the war in Iraq in her speech last night?
Yes. And also when I call up her office, the people just didn't, they were just there. They take the information. We can't tell you, you know, what she's thinking about this and put you off. And I was really quite pleasantly surprised. And that's what I wanted to put out, is she is really a dynamic woman. And she was articulate and forceful and very energetic. And I think the problem, this is what I wanted your perspective on, but in putting this out to everybody, she has been really strong in Congress in working for the environment, for the Alaskan preservation, for fighting the oil companies and working for energy efficient, you know, renewable resources. But where it has seemed weak to me, and I think this is why so many, a large number of people in Washington state think that she's not doing her job, is it doesn't seem that she has understood the connection that since it's not business as usual, that she needed to stand, and it's not just about her work for Washington, but what's happening nationally to the country.
Yeah, this is a debate that's being played out across the country, Maureen, and thank you for the call. You have Democratic politicians who have, when Bill Clinton started the Democratic Leadership Council back in 1980 or thereabouts, the only way to get money, the Democrats typically had, you know, the major money source for Democrats had been the unions. And the unions were under attack. Ronald Reagan declared war on the unions Bill Clinton started in 1990. And Ronald Reagan in 1980 had declared war on organized labor in the United States. And we went from 25% of our workforce being unionized in, when Reagan came into office in 1980 to around 7% right now, the private workforce. And so Clinton's looking around going, where can we get money? Well, the Republicans are getting all this money from these corporations. Why don't we? And the DLC has been moving down that road ever since of let's get in bed with the corporations. Let's be Republican light. And I'm not a supporter of that. I'm not a fan of the DLC. And there are a number of Democrats who've been taking the DLC positions, which range from, you know, being in favor of the war in Iraq to being in favor of free trade agreements to being in favor of things like the bankruptcy bill, basically rewriting legislation on behalf of the corporations. And without naming any particular politician specifically, because, hey, this is where the lobbyists are. This is where the money is. Maybe some Democrats, actually, that's where their belief is. But, if you got Evan Bayh and Rahm Emanuel out there, these guys promoting the DLC. And I just think they're conscienceless. I have a big problem with it. But it's really a whole separate topic we'll have to get back to some other time. Gary in Jackson, Mississippi. Hey, Gary, what's up?
Yes. Good to talk to you, Tom. Thank you.
Thank you, Gary. We only have about a minute left here.
Okay. I was going to refer to the driver in Flagstaff, Arizona.
Yes, sir.
I, too, used to do that and fell under that same misconception there. And I got hurt pretty badly that required surgery. I broke some bones in my back and in my foot because the place was so filthy that a forklift couldn't stop and ran over me.
Ouch.
So I had no problem after the surgery with the cost and everything to sue the insurance company that refused to pay.
Mm-hmm.
And Senator Paul Simon was in at that time. He's a good family friend.
Mm-hmm.
And he sent me a copy of a page out of the law book. And it's in Title 46 of the U.S. Code. And it's Section 111-09.
I'm still listening, Gary. Got it. Just a second here to wrap it up.
Okay, it states in there that it's a receiver's responsibility to unload. That has not been amended or changed in any way. We won a lawsuit on that.
Oh, that's
so
interesting.
We do have protection.
Interesting. Gary, thanks a lot for the heads up. So Walmart charging the receivers, or charging the deliverers a fee. Oh, man, this is... I don't have personal knowledge of this, so I can't just put it out that that's how it is, that our caller's story is how it is. But if it is, man, that's a problem. Pat Buchanan up next, 57 minutes past the hour.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back for your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity. Tom Hartman here with you. Pat Buchanan's on the line with us. He has a new book out, State of Emergency, The Third World Invasion and Conquest of America. Pat Buchanan, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much, Tom.
You are suggesting in this book that Mexico is essentially that forces in Mexico, essentially the oligarchy of Mexico, is planning to annex seven states in the United States?
What I'm suggesting is the oligarchy in Mexico suddenly came to realize that the illegal aliens they had sent into the United States or let go were a tremendous asset to them from three standpoints. First, it eases their problems because they get rid of their poor and they're unemployed and they're uneducated. And they reduce the pressures for revolution against a corrupt regime. Secondly, they get $16 billion back in remittances, and every illegal alien that comes into the United States sends money back to his family, so they benefit that way. And third, they realize they have an extraordinary political asset. And so two Mexican presidents have come up here in recent years and told Mexicans here and Mexican Americans that you really are part of our own nation. You are really Mexicans here. And they've changed their constitution so that you can now be a Mexican-American and a citizen of Mexico as well. The whole idea, Tom, is to increase their influence dramatically, first and foremost in the United States. Secondly, the President of Mexico favors a complete erasure of borders along the lines of the European Union, even more so. And third, Mexican intellectuals and Mexican consuls and Mexican officials are delighting in the fact that they appear to be reannexing the American Southwest, not militarily, but linguistically, culturally, ethnically. You see, native-born Americans are moving out of California for the first time since the Spanish came. By 2050, we'll have over 100 million Hispanic folks, the majority of them Mexican, and the majority concentrated in the American Southwest.
But when the Spanish first came to California, they were not the native-born California. I mean, just to put a fine point on it.
Well, let me address the fine point. You know how many people were in California at the time we took it over? About 4,000. They were Spaniards. They were ranchers. They were soldiers, you know, dealing with the Indians. That was an unpopulated land.
Wait a minute. You mean the Indians were not people?
Well, the Indians were not citizens of Mexico, no.
Well, they were citizens of something. I mean, they were living there. But let's set that aside.
Well, you
want
to give it back to the Indians, that's fine, but I don't think the Mexicans are entitled to it.
I'm not suggesting that. And Pat Buchanan, I'm one of the liberals, one of the progressives out there who has been saying for a long, long time that nations need to have immigration policies, the nations need to have membranes called both borders and trade policies. I see this and our, you know, joining the WTO and NAFTA and all this as part of the same package.
It is.
Which is the dissolving of the boundaries that create nationhood.
Exactly. That is what the Mexican elite are doing, but the militants have a separate but a parallel agenda with the elites.
Yeah, I understand. The place where I start to... You know, I can make these arguments based on economics, right? Mm-hmm. The reason why a country should control the influx of immigration to their country is because you want to have a relationship between the number of people available for work and the amount of work that needs to be done. Otherwise, the cost of labor is going to go through the floor. I mean, this is David Ricardo, 1814, right? Mm-hmm. Just basic economics.
All right.
But when we start making the argument based on language and culture, that's where it concerns me that we're starting to slip into the realm of culturism and racism and that raises the question, Pat Buchanan, what is American culture?
All right. This is the point, I guess, where we're going to disagree. To me, it is the culture that makes a country. It is not the economy. As one of the individuals
I'm not disagreeing with you on that.
If you have two cultures, you will wind up with two countries. That's what Abba Ibn said, and he said it's neat why we need two states long, long before the Israelis considered the idea.
Sure.
What is happening is the folks who are coming here, first, they are not assimilating into traditional American culture, the entry of which is, of course, American language, but it is a common history, heroes, holidays, all of the things, books, movies, all of these things that are part of the culture that make us exactly who we are and that make us a different, a separate, and a unique people.
But Pat Buchanan, your ancestors are you know,
right?
You're still celebrating the holidays of your ancestors with St. Patrick's Day in
uh-huh.
New York. I mean, it's the fact of the matter, and my grandfather and grandmother came to this country in 1917 from Norway on my father's side. My mother's family has been here since the 1600s, but my father's family came here recently. The history... And when my grandparents came over, they joined a Norwegian ghetto, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we saw this with the Poles, and we saw this with the Italians, and we saw this with the
uh-huh.
with the Irish. I mean, the idea of at least for one generation there being a bridge
is kind
of normal with immigration. Are you suggesting that Mexicans are coming into this country specifically are coming into this country so rapidly that the normal process of assimilation isn't possible? Or are you suggesting that there's some very specific and intentional plot behind this to avoid there ever being that assimilation?
I'm suggesting both and even more. First off, Mexicans coming here aren't coming here to be Americans. They're coming here to work. They don't want to be Americans. They're very proud Mexicans. When they go out to Los Angeles Coliseum, they cheer for the Mexican team, and they throw trash at the American team. They
want
to retain
some,
their language.
But not all.
Let me finish, Tom. They want to retain their language, their culture, their music, all of that separate. They create small communities of little Mexicos, like Little Havana. In Cuba only, there are about 20 times as many Mexican folks here. Secondly, they go back and forth across the border. Third, the melting pot that worked for our grandparents or great-grandparents is not only cracked and broken, the American elite does not believe in it anymore. It says that's cultural genocide. They should retain their own language, culture, and all the rest of it separate from the rest of us. All of these things are working together to prevent assimilation and Americanization. Fourth or third, what we had and what we need desperately now is a 40-year timeout on immigration as we had from 1924 to 1965. That's why the kids I went to school with, whose fathers or grandfathers were Polish and Italian and every other thing in Catholic schools, all spoke English. By 1960, 97% of us spoke the English language. We were assimilated, acculturated into American
society. I understand the process. My grandparents refused to teach my father Norwegian, which I always thought was a shame. But, you know, because
it was most important that they learn English.
Right.
As John Quincy Adams said, look forward to your posterity rather than backwards to your ancestors.
So slowing this process down, and I've worked in Central and South America, and I'll tell you, the problem that I see, particularly, I spent a fair amount of time in Bogota, Colombia, working in the slums of Bogota. And the big problem that I see is the oligarchs, is the corruption, the ownership of government by a few wealthy families combined with the influence of the Catholic Church that is making birth control virtually unavailable, if not illegal in many places. And so you have these explosions of population and explosions of poverty. And like you said, we're a great safety valve for the country of Mexico. And the main way that we're doing that is by providing employment. Instead of going after the people, instead of personalizing this, wouldn't it be much more rational for us to simply say anybody who employs somebody in the United States who's not a citizen is going to face jail time?
Well, I do think, what you're saying is George Bush ought to enforce the existing immigration laws.
Yes, I'm saying that.
He ought to enforce the immigration laws against businesses. There ought to be perp walks for these guys that chronically do this repeatedly. They ought to lose the deductibility of the wages they got. That's exactly right. But the president also is under a constitutional obligation to defend the states from invasion. And when you got him, the president, saying 6 million people tried to break into the United States, and he's not sure exactly how many made it, but we stopped 6 million in his term, and 1 in 12 had a criminal record, you've got an invasion. This is the crisis in America that needs to be dealt with first and now, and not wait till we get a guest worker or amnesty program that La Raza likes.
Yeah. Well, I'm not in favor of a guest worker amnesty program, frankly. I think that's slave labor. I mean,
And what it is they come in. Look, they're not evil. None of these are evil people. 3,000 have died trying to come in. They're desperate people. They're misgoverned down there. They got terrible economic and social conditions. They're not bad people.
Yeah, we need
but
to give them
they can't come in and take jobs of American workers.
Yep. Patrick J. Buchanan, the new book, State of Emergency, The Third World Invasion and Conquest of America. Pat Buchanan, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom.
Good talking with you. 16 minutes past the hour. The place where progressives fiendishly plot for total world domination, or at least a clean election and maybe a decent job. 16 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Bosses of the world unite, let us save the day. Malcontents without 5 cents want us to cut our pay. We only make 500 times as much as our average worker drones. We work just as hard, and we too sometimes need to paint our homes. The pressures are incredible, and no one seems to care. We moved our plants to Haiti, and now we have to move from there. They're clamoring for more than a dollar a day from Malaysia to Mexico. At that rate, pretty soon there'll be no place for us to go.
The poor billionaires for Bush. Bosses of the world tonight. Welcome back. 22 minutes past the hour. Well, having a conversation with Pat Buchanan about this is in the quite a lot of discussion about it in the chat room, which you can get to at tomhartman.com. You know, yes, a clock is broken. Even a broken clock is right twice a day. And I think Glenn said, you know, Pat Buchanan is like a 12-step program. You can take what's useful and leave the rest. but the fact of the matter is that, you know, we are facing a problem. It's a very real problem here in the United States of America, and it's the consequence of conservative economic policies. And we'll get into that in more detail in a few minutes. Right now, Victoria Jones is on the line. She's our hard-pressed for work correspondent in Washington, D.C. Hey, Victoria.
Well, hey, Tom. I mean, it's just pathetic. I mean, Washington, D.C. is sad. It's even the president's left today. He's participating in a panel on health transparency in Minnesota. Then he's attending Backman for Congress and a Minnesota Republican Party reception. So cynics might say that he's traveling on the taxpayer's dollar to go to a fundraiser.
Cynics. Mm-hmm.
Cynics would say that.
Now, yesterday in his press conference, he renamed the Democratic Party. Here's the clip.
What matters is that in this campaign that we clarify the different point of view. And there are a lot of people in the Democrat Party.
Now, there ain't no such thing as a Democrat Party, Victoria Jones.
No.
How come nobody's called him on this?
I think people are so used to his verbal gaffes that they don't think anything of it.
But this isn't a verbal gaffe. This is something that Ken Melman is doing. This is something that Bill Frist is doing. This is something Denny Hastert is doing. This is something Republicans right across the board are doing. And they're doing it because Frank Luntz told them that when people hear Democrat, and particularly if you emphasize the rat, it doesn't make them smile. And when people hear Democratic, it does make them smile.
You really think that's going on?
Oh, I can prove it. I'm back in the 1980s. Frank Luntz did the psychological work on this stuff, and Newt Gingrich came up with this whole plan of we're going to refer to it as the Democrat Party, not the Democratic Party. You get 100 people in a room and you hook them up to Frank Luntz's people meter and you say Democrat, and it causes them to think of specific politicians or political processes. You say Democratic, and it makes them think of the ideals on which this country was founded. Democratic actually evokes a positive emotion in people. The word Democrat generally tends to, other than with Democrats themselves, tends to evoke a neutral emotion in people. And so the Republicans decided that they were going to deprive the Democratic Party of the name of their own party. This is psychological warfare being conducted by the Republicans. Very intentional, very well thought out, and it's been going on for 20 years, and I'm just astounded that the press isn't calling on the president on this.
Why don't the senior Democrats get on the air about it? If they bring attention to it, it'll make it worse?
I am equally horrified by that. Every time I see a Democrat, a member of the Democratic Party, sitting on one of these TV talk shows next to a Republican, and the Republican says, well, when the Democrat Party, and the Democrat doesn't say anything, what they should say is, well, when the Republican Party, or when the Repunican Party, or when the Repucicon Party. I mean, you know, the Democrats, at the very least, should say, hey, wait a minute, that's not the name of our party. Quit changing our name.
Right.
I mean, it boggles my mind. I just want to grab some of these people and slap them silly.
It is astonishing. Yes, it would be like calling it the Republic Party.
Yeah, yeah. And this is, I mean, I got one of our listeners got a fundraising letter from Senator Gordon Smith, a Republican from Oregon, the other day that referred to the Democrat Party four times in the letter. And this is in writing. The Democrat Party, the Democrat Party, the Democrat, you know, four times in the fundraising letter to other Republicans. It's like this used to be a slur. Back when Joe McCarthy referred to the Democrat Party, it was a slur. It was like throwing the N-word around back in those days. And nobody did it except Joe McCarthy. I mean, nobody. And now they're doing it all the time. So, anyhow, you've heard my rant.
That is, you know, it's fascinating. I had not noticed it, and I'm sure now I'm going to hear it all the time.
Yeah, start.
Now that I'm aware of it.
And start, the question I would love for you to start asking Democratic politicians is, why are you allowing Republicans to rename your party? Thomas Jefferson named it in 1800, the Democratic Republican Party. They dropped the Republican from the name in 1830, and it's been called the Democratic Party. It's the longest lived political party in the history of civilization, founded by Thomas Jefferson, and they're letting the Republicans not just redefine their positions, but rename their party. Why?
It's pretty astonishing.
It is. It is. Ask some Democrats and let me know what they say, okay?
All right, then I will.
Okay, thank you. Victoria Jones, TalkRadioNews.com, the Talk Radio News Service, our favorite hard-pressed-for-work correspondent. 27 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you on the True People's Radio program.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
What gives you the right, hey you, to stand there and tell me what to do? Tell me what gave you the power to stop me from living like I do? Remember,
welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. The place for being progressive never felt so good. The Tom Hartman radio program. Our telephone number, toll free across the United States, 1-866-440-8466, 440-THOM. And our activism alert for the day.
May take all week, damn it. May take long.
Down. Yeah, it may, but.
They got the guns, but we got the number.
Yeah, we do.
Gonna win, yeah, we're taking over. Come on!
There you go. Patrick Leahy, the Democratic senator from Vermont, sent out an email suggesting the people should sign a petition to send to George Bush telling him to please follow the law. Now that a judge in Detroit has ruled that he has broken the law for these many 4 or 5 years here. And I would add to that, that we should contact the White House and tell George Bush that the Democratic Party is called the Democratic Party, not the Democrat Party, and he should clean up his language, his use of language. So, number one, tell him to abide by Judge Diggs' decision, and number two, tell him that it's called the Democratic Party, not the Democrat Party, and frankly, the easy way to do it is to simply call the White House at 202-456-1414. 202-456-1414, and just say, hey, please pass this message along to Mr. Bush, the resident in chief, that Judge Diggs' decision should stand and that it's the Democratic Party, not the Democrat Party. 440-8466, our telephone number. And Jonathan in Santa Monica, California. Hey, Jonathan, what's on your mind today?
Good morning, Tom. You've been talking about the Republicans' perversion of the language of debate.
Yes.
And you mentioned the Frank Luntz connection in 20 years. I think that since Goldwater's loss in 64, the Republican Party has made a concerted, systematic effort to control the media, to control the language, control the debate. And I was first made aware of every single Republican referring to the Democratic Party as a Democrat Party in an op-ed piece I read several months ago. And the author...
Is it the one that I wrote?
No, it was written by a columnist. I think it was Robert Scheer when he was still with the L.A. Times.
Yeah, I wrote a piece about this 3 or 4 months ago on Common Dreams that got circulated all over the blogosphere.
The author of this piece suggested using the word Republican't because they can't govern.
Good one. Good one. Good one, Jonathan. Thank you for sharing that. This is Newt Gingrich was really on top of this thing. And Newt Gingrich back in 1996, this is the GOPAC memo, the GOP Political Action Committee. And he comes right out and says, as you know, one of the key points of the GOPAC tapes is that language matters. In the video, We Are the Majority, language is listed as a key mechanism of control used by a majority party, along with agenda, rules, attitude, and learning. I'm quoting Newt Gingrich now. As the tapes have been used in training sessions across the country and mailed to candidates, we've heard a plaintiff plea, I wish I could speak like Newt. That takes years of practice, but we believe that you could have significant impact on your campaign and the way you communicate if we help a little. That is why we created this list of words and phrases. Memorize as many as possible. Read them. And remember that any tool, like any tool, these words will not help if they are not used. Okay, so he goes on. Positive, optimistic governing words. Use the list below to help define your campaign and your vision of public service. These words help give extra power to your message. In addition, these words help develop the positive side of the contrast you should create with your opponent, giving your community something to vote for. So whenever you refer, whenever a Republican candidate refers to himself or his party, he should use words like this: actively, activist, building, candid, caring, challenge, change, children, choice, choose, citizen, commitment, common sense, compete, confident, conflict, control, courage, crusade, debate, dream, duty. Eliminate good time in prison, empowerment, fair, family, freedom, hard work, help, humane, incentive, initiative, lead, learn, liberty, legacy, light, listen, mobilize, moral, movement, opportunity, passion, peace, pioneer, precious, premise, preserve, principled, pristine, pro-flag, pro-children, pro-environment, pro-reform, prosperity, protect, proud, pride, provide, reform, rights, share, strength, success, tough, truth, unique, vision, we, us, our. On the other hand, often we search, again, I'm quoting Newt Gingrich here, often we search hard for words to define our opponents. That would be those Democrats, right? Sometimes we are hesitant to use contrast. Remember that creating a difference helps you. These are powerful words that can create a clear and easily understood contrast. Apply these words to your opponent, his record, proposals, and their party. Abuse of power. Anti-flag, anti-family, anti-child, anti-jobs, betray, bizarre, bosses, bureaucracy, cheat, coercion, collapsing, consequences, corrupt, corruption, criminal rights, crisis, cynicism, decay, deeper, destroy, destructive, devour, disgrace, endanger, excuses, fail, greed, hypocrisy, ideological, impose, incompetent, insecure, insensitive, intolerant, liberal, lie, limit, machine, mandate, obsolete, pathetic, patronage, permissive attitude, pessimistic, punish, poor, radical, red tape, self-serving, selfish, sensationalist, shallow, shame, sick, spending, stagnation, status quo, steal, taxes, they, them, threaten, traitors, unionized, urgent, waste, and welfare. That's from Newt Gingrich in 1996. 1-866-440-8466. Tom in Minneapolis. Hey, Tom.
Yeah, this reminds me when you always say the GOP playing chess while the Dems are playing checkers.
Yeah.
Victoria's response was very telling. She's acted like she never heard of such a thing. She goes, it is so fascinating. Now, I love Victoria, but she's supposed to be a liberal, and this is the first she's heard of this?
I know. I was frankly startled by that.
Yeah. And David Sirota, by the way, just did an op-ed last week on, it's called Politics 101, Don't Reinforce Your Opponent's Lies. And he goes into this whole thing about redefining the word moderate and centrist and all this stuff.
Yep.
So it's a good op-ed. But I wanted to just let you know, and your listeners, you know, I call NPR and challenge these cons all the time, and I always manage to get in the word Republican Great Depression. And I love watching them defend that it wasn't.
Yeah,
and
right.
And I always, because I start off with that their mission is to dismantle the New Deal, has been and still is, and then I get segue into the Republican Great Depression, and I love watching them flail and try to defend that it wasn't Hoover and Coolidge.
Yep.
And
yep. Well said, Tom, and we all need to be emulating you. You do a marvelous job. Thank you very much for that. Jeff in Tacoma, and for calling. Jeff in Tacoma, Washington. Hey, Jeff.
Tom, second time in 2 days. I love your show, man.
Thank you. What's up?
Well, you just busted out with Republican, and I love the Republican Party.
Right.
And And just to be really nasty, the Republicans.
Yes, and that's one that maybe Clarence Thomas would be very fond of. The Republicans. Okay, Jeff, thanks a lot. Good to hear from you. Bob in Shelton, Washington. Hey, Bob.
Hi there, Tom. I'm sorry. I just wanted to make a comment about the fellow that called earlier. I believe he was an author of a book. He was defending the he seemed to be defending the business people by saying that most of them have not yet been convicted of a felony.
Yeah, that was... Yeah.
But, you know, this really reminded me that I think one of the key things that maybe isn't addressed enough is that the motivation of conservatives and Republicans. And I'm becoming more and more convinced that you don't get anywhere by talking issues, because these people are basically motivated by either greed or a desire to suck up and be part of the in crowd.
Yeah. There's this sense in America that goes back to the founding of this country that we're all in this together, that has been absolutely abandoned by the conservatives in the Republican Party. It's tragic.
Yeah. And one thing I did before I hang up, there's some commentary that to me has always been very interesting that I'd like to kind of pass on. The Republicans like to, amongst their heroes, Teddy Roosevelt, Abraham Lincoln, and I think George Bush likes to compare himself particularly to Teddy Roosevelt.
Mm.
Well, Teddy Roosevelt...
Which is a very bad analogy. It's a very bad analogy. Bush is no Teddy Roosevelt. You were saying, though.
And he quit the Republican Party, and one of the quotes, it's a pretty close to a direct quote, I believe, is he was talking about people who were defending the big businessmen and all that stuff back in that day, and he referred to them as fawning and servile.
Yes, you will find actually several of Teddy Roosevelt's quotes about the influence of big business and the dangers of that influence in my book, Unequal Protection, The Rise of Corporate Dominance and the Theft of Human Rights.
Your book?
Yeah. Yeah, and it was amazing when I was writing that book, going through and reading some of Teddy Roosevelt's speeches. I play the audio from some of them from time to time here on the radio program, and it's just you get it that this guy got it. Teddy Roosevelt, you know, got what was going on, and was going to challenge it, was going to do something about it. Bob, thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it, and good to hear from you. 45 minutes past the hour here on the Tom Hartman radio program, the pill that will help you escape the matrix. We'll be right back.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Here in the city, shrouded in smoke, 10 million people this morning awoke to a future of cancer, industrial disease. So let's build some more suburbs and buy SUVs. Cut down the mountains, burn all the coal, and put all the money in a humongous bowl. They'll call it progress, and they'll blame it on you to end life as we know it, to enrich the few. I'm talking to you from here at the end of the world.
And welcome back to Truth and Common Sense in Broadcasting, the Tom Hartman radio program. That's me. He loves to cuss. Gets a jolly when a mountain biker wipes out trying to keep up with him, and now we're learning that the first frat boy loves flatulence jokes. This from over at Huffington Post. It's actually a quote from U.S. News and World Report by Paul Bedard. A top insider let that slip when explaining why President Bush is paranoid around women, always worried about his behavior. But they say he's still a funny, earthy guy who, for example, can't get enough of fart jokes. He's also known to cut a few for laughs. That's farts. Especially when greeting new young aides. But forget about getting people to guess about that. I mean, sometimes you hear this stuff and you think, you know, have we just, like, gone over the edge into the Twilight Zone? Is that our first frat boy? That's the more gas than mass department. In the more mass than gas department, the flip side of this, U.S. astronomers say they've found the first direct evidence for the mysterious stuff called dark matter. This is serious. It doesn't emit or reflect enough light to be seen. It's thought to make up a quarter of the universe. And they found some evidence of it, you know, without getting into all the... But 70% of the universe, dark matter, you can't see it. More mass than gas, it says in the headline. Yeah. Well, maybe the Republicans could come up with a name for the party that incorporates flatulence, the Republic Flatulent Party or something like that, and then the frat boy in chief, our first frat boy, would love it. I don't know. It's 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Andrew in New York City. Hey, Andrew.
Hey, Tom.
What's up?
First of all, I just want to say it's a pleasure to talk to you and keep getting the good word out.
Thank you. I'll do it.
Yeah.
You too.
Anyway, my little two bits to the thing would be Republicronian.
Ah, the Republic cronies. Yes, a good one. Good one.
Yeah.
Good contribution. Andrew,
yeah.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Good to hear from you. Rebecca in Edmond, Washington. Hey, Rebecca.
Good morning. Hi. About language, first of all, I used to teach junior high, and the flatulence jokes remind me just of, you know, upper elementary or junior high kids. That's preoccupation of theirs.
I think that's the level of emotional maturity
yep.
we
yep.
have
I
in this
guy.
I think
it is. Okay, yesterday you mentioned the Islamofascists and how the Republicans are trying to preempt those who are justifiably referring to the Republicans as Christofascists or fascists at the very least.
Mm-hmm.
And Rick Santorum on Hardball yesterday used the term Islamofascist three or more times.
Oh, yeah.
For the first time ever, I heard Bush use the Democrat Party phrase.
Yeah, this was
In this campaign, that we clarify the different point of view. And there are a lot of people in the Democrat Party.
Mm-hmm. There it is.
Yeah, well, I've heard his cronies use it a lot, and they're all on the same script. But this is the first time I'd heard the boss use it.
Yeah.
So finally, they've clued him in.
Yep.
And then finally, I wanted to mention that Chris Matthews really missed a good opportunity, and I wrote to him about it. Bush said in his press conference yesterday, we will not leave Iraq, absolutely not, while I'm the president. But in a previous speech, he said, when the Iraqi people want us to leave or when they ask us to leave, we will leave. And yesterday, it's as if the Iraqi people don't matter at all.
That's right. That's right. Boy, is that a good point. Rebecca, thank you for sharing that with me. It's I don't know how that's slipped by me. You're brilliant. That's great. Thank you very much.
Thank
I appreciate
you work.
It. You too. Dara in Felton, Delaware. Dara, am I pronouncing it right?
Yes, you are.
Hey, Dara,
you.
What's up?
It's a great show.
Thank
your
you.
Show. Okay, first of all, the president is the one who foisted No Child Left Behind and all those tests on kids.
Yeah. It's actually the No Testing Corporation owned by his brother, Neil,
mm-hmm.
Left Behind is really what it should have been called.
Well, shouldn't he be modeling the correct behavior to children by using proper English?
One would think so.
Yeah, I mean,
one would certainly think so.
It's
not happening.
Between adjectives and nouns here.
Yeah.
The other thing is
Democrat being a noun and Democratic being
the adjective.
The adjective, yeah.
Yes. The other thing. When you were talking to Pat Buchanan, I don't agree with Pat Buchanan on everything, but I do agree with a lot of what he's saying about this issue with
mm-hmm.
with the immigration.
Yeah, I find myself in that same uncomfortable position.
Yes. You almost think you want to wash your mouth out with soap for saying it. What I've noticed about this immigration issue is that it's class warfare is what it is, and it's class warfare from the left and from the right.
Yes. Both sides are doing it. It's amazing because I've written a couple of op-eds saying that this is really, you know, we should be talking about the criminal corporations that are hiring people, but still this is going to drive down wages. And I get attacked from you know, emails from the left and you know, saying, oh, you know, you're being a toady to the right wingers, and then the right wingers are like, no, we gotta, you know, it's bizarre. It's absolutely bizarre. Dara, I gotta move along. David in Eugene, Oregon, you've got the last 30 seconds of this hour. Hey, David.
Hello?
David? Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Justin, we have to wrap up the show in just a second.
I call them Republicans because they're so repugnant.
Maybe we should just call them the Repugnant Party. It's like in the chat room, there's this big debate about, you know, how can you find a word that rolls off the tongue, you know, that's sayable.
Well, I hope I did it.
Republicans.
Yeah.
Republicans. You got to practice that one, though. Republicans. I don't know. It's a shot. David, thanks a lot for the call. And Dara, thank you for the call before that. 56 minutes past the hour on the program where reason is our lifestyle choice. Gee, what a novel idea. The Tom Hartman Radio Program.
been listening to the Tom Hartman Program, check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
Well, I got to tell you, I was rather amazed by it when I saw it in USA Today a week or so ago. There was this hit piece on Al Gore. I read it, and I had heard some of the charges in it before, and I believed them to be lies at the time I heard them. But there it was in USA Today. Peter Schweizer had written a piece in which he said that Gore had a zinc mine on his property that was polluting the rivers, and that he was not really offsetting the carbon from flying around in his jet, that instead his movie company was doing that, and that he owned Occidental Petroleum stock, that he was an oil baron. And there it was in USA Today, and I remember, this was, you know, what, a couple of weeks ago, I guess. I remember reading this thing and thinking, in fact, looking here at the date, it was the 9th of August, August 9th, Peter Schweizer's piece in the USA Today. And I remember thinking, wow, here it is in USA Today. Maybe it's true. And I thought, you know, it's a shame. It doesn't diminish my respect for Al Gore or for his message. But it's a shame. I mean, you would think that he'd be a smarter politician than that, if nothing else. I mean, even if he wanted to just, like, cynically go around promoting global warming, you'd think he would make his behavior congruent with this message. There was also a thing about how big his house was. Well, you know, I mean, come on. The guy was the vice president. I guess he's got a big family. Who knows? But in any case, but then USA Today printed a correction. Came down, you know, a little later, but turned out that the guy who had written this hit piece on Al Gore that repeated these charges, allegations, were lies. Lies is what they were. That he actually worked at the Hoover Institution, this right-wing think tank. And so on page 10... USA Today said, in a column that appeared August 10th on the forum page, writer Peter Schweizer inaccurately stated that former Vice President Al Gore receives royalties from a zinc mine on his property in Tennessee despite his environmental advocacy. He no longer does, as the mine was closed in 2003. Okay, so USA Today printed a retraction or an apology or a correction. But that didn't stop Rich Lowry. Who is this guy? I've never heard of him. Apparently, he was filling in for Sean Hannity yesterday. And this on Fox News, Hannity and Combs program. Here's the clip.
But a recent article in USA Today exposes that Gore may not be as green as he seems. Gore uses a private plane to promote his new film. He says he uses renewable energy credits to offset the pollution created by the jet, but these are actually paid for by the film's distributor.
Turns out that's a lie, not true.
For years, Gore has controlled hundreds of thousands of dollars of stock in Occidental Petroleum.
Turns out that's a lie. Not true. He's never owned stock in Occidental Petroleum. His father did many long years ago, but Al Gore has never owned stock in Occidental Petroleum.
A major oil company that has been accused of drilling in environmentally sensitive areas. And Gore receives $20,000 a year in royalties from Pasminco Zinc, which operates a zinc concession on his property in Tennessee. The company has been cited for dumping large quantities of barium, iron, and zinc into the Caney Fork River.
And it turns out that's not true either. So there you go. It's all debunked over at thinkprogress.org. He does not receive royalties from a zinc mine. He never owned Occidental Petroleum stock. And he does pay for his own carbon offsets. Individually. Paramount is also buying some, but that's over and beyond what Gore is doing individually. So, you know, the bottom line here is these Reichwingers who have really nothing more to say on global warming, because all you have to do is look around you and figure out that, you know, this is real, what's going on. It's real and it's dangerous. They had nothing more to say on it. They've been exposed as liars and frauds. And so now they're trying to lie about Al Gore. And, you know, what a shame. There's a certain point where you can't even, I mean, or at least I can't even get angry about it. It's more like sad. You look at what these cons are doing and the extent, the lengths to which they'll go to lie about people, to maintain their wealth and power, to promote and amplify their ideology. It is truly tragic. I just don't know how to describe it beyond that. It's tragic. Another one of the memes that the cons have been putting out for a week or two is that today, the 22nd of August, was going to be the end of the world. Today was going to be the apocalypse. Why? Because Iran, see, this is all the hyping Iran as a threat stuff. Because Iran had said some months ago that today, on August 22nd, they would report back to the European Union and the United Nations about whether or not they would accept the offer of, I believe it's five countries in Europe to help them out with their nuclear program in exchange for their not building bombs. And so all the cons, well, oh, they picked a date, August 22nd. Well, that must be some significant, well, there's some back, there's this obscure Muslim holiday, holy, weird, strange things happen, whatever, and that's got to be it. It's going to be the apocalypse. And they were talking about, well, Iran, that's going to be the date, August 22nd, when Iran is going to have fire over Jerusalem to fulfill the prophecy. Well, as usual, the cons were hallucinating. This in the Associated Press today. Iran's top nuclear negotiator said Tuesday that Iran is now ready to enter serious negotiations, in quotes, over its disputed nuclear program, but did not say whether it was willing to suspend uranium enrichment, the West's key demand. The negotiator, Ali Larijani, hand-delivered Iran's response to a Western package of nuclear incentives aimed at persuading it to suspend enrichment. He gave the reply to ambassadors from Britain, China, Russia, France, Germany, and Switzerland, state-run television said, without disclosing details. To the countries that proposed the package, state-run television quoted Larijani as telling the envoys, Iran is prepared as of August 23rd to enter serious negotiations. Iranian officials close to the meeting said Iran offered a new formula to resolve the dispute as part of its formal response to the Western incentive package. The officials spoke on condition of anonymity because of the sensitivity of the information. So, gee, the world has not ended. Iran has said, okay, we'll work this thing out. Now, we have no idea what the terms are. They may be reasonable, they may be unreasonable, might be a good idea, might be a bad idea. But it was just, you know, that window of opportunity for the right-wingers to get out there and hype the, look out for Iran. These guys are crazy. They're Islamo-fascists. Was used. And they just absolutely made the most of it that they could. And now, you know, frankly, it's a good thing that we passed on it, that we ignored it. But it's a tragedy that it happened at all. And here's the, in fact, this is the Wall Street Journal, Bernard Lewis.
What is the significance of August 22nd? This might well be deemed an appropriate date for the apocalyptic ending of Israel and, if necessary, of the world. It is far from certain that Mr. Ahmadinejad plans any such cataclysmic events precisely for August 22nd, but it would be wise to bear the possibility in mind.
Be afraid. Be very afraid.
I mean, see, this is their message, right? Actually, let me not make that a subliminal command.
Be calm. Be very calm. Just relax. Life is good.
There, how's that? A little better. Okay. National Review, Joel Rosenberg.
We all hope and pray that August 22nd is not the day Ahmadinejad is chosen to launch the apocalypse, but there is little doubt in the White House and at the CIA that the Iranian leader is feverishly trying to build, buy, or steal nuclear weapons and that he will quite likely use them once he has them. Yeah, right. I'm sorry, you guys, you just can't scare me anymore. Front Page Magazine. Will Ahmadinejad attempt to make good on those threats this year on the anniversary of the Mirage? M-I-R-A-J, August 22nd, illuminating the night sky over Jerusalem. Will Western powers heed Farid Ghadri's words and move to stop Iran before it's too late? These guys are just panicked. Meanwhile, remember Jose Padilla? Held for years without even being told what the charges were against him? Well, a federal judge in Miami has dismissed the lead terror count against Jose Padilla, the U.S. citizen once identified as a dirty bomb suspect and detained for 3 years without charges as an enemy combatant. Now, this is the point at which the next step from the judge should be to say to Alberto Gonzalez, you, sir, have violated the Constitution by holding this guy in jail for 3 years. You, sir, can go sit in his spot. 16 minutes past the hour.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
George, stop lying. Welcome back. Viagra for your brain. It's the Tom Hartman program. Just don't tell Limbaugh. He'll want some. 21 minutes past the hour. I think I said that. Let's check out what's going on with the U.S. occupation of Iraq.
I want to know the men in the shadows of. I want to hear somebody asking them why. They can be counted on to tell us who our enemies are. But they're never the ones to fight and to die. And they're alive.
The following are security and other developments in Iraq reported on Tuesday as of 16:30 Greenwich Mean Time. Gunman in Mosul killed a family of five, including two children, after entering their home in the Al Zinjali district. In Manadian, the bodies of eight fruit traders were found with their throats slit by the road. The men who were from Najaf died on Monday. In Ramadi, gunmen killed one of the bodyguards of the governor of Anbar in a drive-by shooting. In Mogadia, 15 people were wounded in a mortar attack on a market. Near Kirkuk, gunmen killed two police on the main road near Kirkuk. In Baghdad, the body of Dawood Salman, an employee of the Shiite Endowment, a religious foundation that cares for mosques, was found in the South Sidia district of Baghdad. Near Hila, the body of a man with gunshot wounds to the head was found near that city. In Baqaba, gunmen killed a police major and seriously wounded his driver. In Mosul, gunmen killed a man in that northern city. In Yusufia, a civilian was killed and two wounded when a roadside bomb went off near a police patrol. In other developments, the trial of former Iraqi President Saddam Hussein and six co-defendants resumed today. All defendants were present. And in Baghdad, a former Iraqi electricity minister was detained on corruption charges and an arrest warrant issued for his successor. Also in Iraq, in today's Wall Street Journal, page one, vital commodity, energy supply is hostage to supply of oil professionals. They start out with a story. Cummins wrote this. They start out with a story of Mohammed El Jabouri. He belongs to Iraq's premier business fraternity, the geologists, engineers, and finance men who run the country's vast oil industry. Well, that sounds kind of good, right? There's a bunch of guys running. You know, they know how to run an oil industry. Well, you know how they say there's good news and bad news? I guess that's the good news. Here's the bad news. To quote Chip Cummins in the
the Wall Street Journal today. Through decades of war and trade sanctions, these professionals kept Iraq pumping. But now they're moving to Jordan. Iraq, sitting atop the biggest conventional oil reserves after Saudi Arabia and Iran, is facing what may be the direst threat yet in eight decades as a petroleum powerhouse, a brain drain. Of the 100 or so managers running the Iraqi oil ministry and its branches in 2003, about two-thirds are no longer at their jobs, according to current and former Iraqi officials and outside analysts. The ministry says it doesn't track this, but it says about 100 officials and lower-level engineers and technicians have been murdered since the U.S.-led invasion, along with about 150 oil field security guards. And in addition to that, he tells the story of how many of these people, the ones who are middle class and above, have simply moved to Jordan. Who's going to run the oil industry? Well, I'm sure Halliburton has a solution for that. George Bush yesterday saying that we are not going to leave Iraq as long as he's president. In other words, saying to the government, the elected government of Iraq, screw you guys, essentially. We're not going to do what you say. Senate Democratic Leader Harry Reid replied, saying, far from spreading freedom and democracy in the Middle East, the Bush administration has watched while extremists grow stronger, Iran goes nuclear, Iraq falls into civil war, and oil and gas prices skyrocket. Staying the course is unacceptable. And this from Faiz, blogging over at thinkprogress.org. One of the effects of the Iraq war has been to encourage and embolden terrorist actors in the Middle East. The bottom line, the conflict in Lebanon may have fueled attacks on U.S. troops. He says it's inspiring growing solidarity between Hezbollah, Hamas, Syria, and Iran, among others. The New York Times reported in the early stages of the fighting in Lebanon that the solidarity between Iraqi and Hezbollah fighters could result in increasing attacks against American troops. Now at least one U.S. commander is reporting that. Rocket attacks on, this from the New York Times, rocket attacks on a U.S. base in eastern Baghdad doubled during the month-long war between Israel and Hezbollah, U.S. Army commander said this week, echoing concerns expressed by other American officials about Iranian support for Shiite militants in Iraq. Lieutenant Colonel Mark A. Bertolini of the 4th Infantry Division said the increase in Katyusha rocket attacks on forward operating base Rustamaya seemed related to the fighting in Lebanon. Faiz notes, as Slate's John Dickerson writes, the question Americans should be asking is whether Bush's policies are inspiring the people who want to kill us. And I would say, you know, looking at it, the answer should be fairly clear. Yes, Bush is radicalizing the world, just like he's radicalized America. So all the greater the tragedy for all of us. 27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back to the radio support group of, by, and for we the people of the United States of America. Our phone number 1-866-440-8466, 440-THOM. And if you'd like to drop into our live chat room and say hi, go to tomhartman.com. However you spell it, will get you there. And just click live chat, and it'll get you right in there. By the way, I have a new book coming out. It's called Screwed, The Undeclared War Against the American Middle Class, which is hitting bookstores any day now. We'll be doing book signings all over. I'll share the schedule with you. It's all over on my website, but anyway, just a heads up. Bill in East Sound, Washington. Hey, Bill, what's up?
Hey, Tom, I think that the natural response for any Democrat present when a Republican uses Democrat Party is to come back with the Republican Party.
Now, the publicans, that's a biblical term, is it not?
Yeah, it's a tax collector.
Yeah, there you go. That's right. That was the word for tax collector, the old Roman word.
And a second definition in the dictionary is a person who runs a bar or a tavern.
Right. So They'll pick your pocket and offer you a drink. Interesting. The Publicans Party. Well, that's a good, we're developing some candidates here, Bill. Thanks a lot for the call.
Okay.
Appreciate it. Good to hear from you. We'll see what we come up. You know, Bart, New York City. Bart has some ideas. Hey, Bart.
How's it going, Tom? First-time caller. I'd like to start off by saying I post on the Majority Report blog, and I'd like to think I speak to for most of the blog when we say that we appreciate the time you spent subbing for Sam and Janine over these multiple occasions.
Oh,
and,
thank you, Bart.
Living in New York City and not owning a computer, I appreciate every chance I get to hear you on the radio.
Thanks.
As for the Republicans and them calling the Democratic Party the Democratic Party, I've actually been referring to the Republican Party as Hezbollah, because, as you probably know, the Arabic translation into English is Party of God, and since the Republican base is basically theocratic, I think it goes very well with what they stand for today.
What about, you know, I've heard people use the phrase the American Taliban.
Yeah, that too, yeah. That
seems like a pretty good one.
That refers, and Sam Cedar actually calls them the Rape Publicans.
Rape Publicans. Yeah. So, well, that's a good one, too.
Go.
Or maybe we could come up with some variation on Taliban, the re-Taliban or something like that. Yeah, I don't know. It hasn't quite totally emerged yet, but I think we're getting there. Bart, thanks for your contribution.
I look forward to seeing you at the New York signing in Brooklyn. Tom,
yeah, I'll be at Vox Pop.
Yep,
look forward to it. Thanks a lot,
Bart. Thanks for the time. Take care.
You're welcome. Thanks for calling. 1-866-440-8466. John in Bellingham. Hey, John.
Hey, Tom. Yeah, I think we should call it the Republic Czech Party.
Republic Czech Party. Why is that? Republic
Czech Party, because there's too many, and actually brand them. I've been thinking about this for a long time, but brand them as a bunch of little Czechs walking around in Washington, D.C. without a balance.
Okay, without a balance.
Because that's all they do. They're writing, they call themselves conservatives, but they continually write checks without paying for them and
right.
give their buddies... and give their buddies tax breaks.
The Republic Bounce Check Party.
The other thing I wanted to follow up on, because a couple of callers, I called yesterday about the argument about whether it's Islamo-fascist or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And a couple of callers after that were stating that it seemed to come out that somehow I'm an extreme right-wing person. Which is not the case. The reason that I relate Saudi Arabians and Dubai and Kuwaitis as Islamic fascists is they are basically doing the exact same thing as these guys are. These corporate fascists, you can call them Christo fascists or whatever, in America, they're doing the same thing in Dubai as far as hiring the cheapest labor from all over the world to come in and do their work, while we're doing the exact same thing in Iraq. We're doing the exact same thing in New Orleans,
the difference, though, John, is that we're merging business and government, and in Saudi Arabia and Oman and Dubai, the government is the royal family. And so
I realize they're monarchies. I totally understand that. And I realize they're tribal.
And frankly, most of them are not. Most of them. I mean, you go to those.
What did you learn in school today, dear little boy of mine? What did you learn in school today, dear little boy of mine? I learned that Washington never told a lie. I learned that soldiers seldom die. I learned that everybody is free. And that's what the teacher said to me. And that's what I learned in school today. That's what I learned in school.
Yeah.
And what did you learn in school today?
Okay, we're back. We had a rather spectacular crash here, I think. And Alex, are we using the GSM or the AAR phone system? GSM. Okay, great. Thank you. I'm having to reconnect here to everything, to Air America in New York. Apparently, all the phone lines dropped. It was just like one of those, whoom! Everything in the building goes down. Welcome back. 43 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. And apologies for the crash, as it were. It's really strange because it crashed in New York. That's fine, Alex. Crashed in New York, and at the same time, I was getting a weird crash message here in Portland, Oregon. I wonder if the entire internet had some weird hiccup. But in any case, who knows? Our listener line, we have listeners can call in and tell us what they have their thoughts are. 503-323-6620 is our listener line. And we've gotten a couple of calls here on recent issues. Here's one.
Yeah, you seem to think that if they steal 5 million votes, that we can turn out 6 million or whatever. I just don't see the logic in that. These guys are determined to steal the election. So if we turn out 6,000 or 6 million, then they'll steal 7 million. I mean, what's to stop them from doing that? I don't understand the logic in your solution. So please explain it. Thank you.
Yeah, well, interesting. Let me explain it then. That's obviously not the best solution. If we know that, if we're pretty sure that they're going to steal 5 million votes this time around, knowing that they stole 4 million or 3 million or 2 million respectively in the last three elections, should we try to come up with 6 million votes? Well, you know, it's an imperfect solution, obviously, but it's a starting point. I mean, there is a certain point at which a vote is so overwhelming that election theft becomes obvious. And I believe that that's what's happened. That's what happened in the Ukraine. I believe that's what happened in Serbia. And frankly, I believe that that's what happened is happening here in the United States. And number one. Number two, the way that they're stealing the votes is not just by the electronic voting machines. Now, I'm convinced in the state of Georgia, for example, that that was a major way that the votes were stolen in the 2002 election when, in my opinion, Max Cleland was actually reelected. And Saxby Chambliss should not be sitting in the United States Senate, for example. But that is not the and then you've got the weird anomaly in New Mexico, another interesting example where people, you know, showed up at polling places and to vote, and they didn't have enough machines, and so some of the folks simply gave them absentee ballots and said, here, you vote on paper, and you folks in that line over here, you vote on the machine. And it had nothing to do with where you lived, you know, what kind of neighborhood you came from, who you were going to vote for, what party you were registered at. It had nothing to do with anything. It was all the same people in the same precinct, you know, in the local schoolhouse or whatever. And when they added up the votes, they discovered that the people who voted on the paper, by and large, a majority of them had voted for Kerry. But the people who voted on the electronic voting machines, the majority of them voted for Bush. And they're still scratching their heads over that one in New Mexico. I mean, that ended up, you know, so yes, they are stealing votes with the electronic voting machines. It sure appears that way anyway. But the main way that they're stealing votes is by disenfranchising people, is by knocking people off the voting rolls, is by preventing people from getting to the polling places, is by frustrating, like they did in New Hampshire, like they were convicted in New Hampshire of jamming the phone lines and Alex, if you're telling me that you fired a break, I'm not hearing it. Okay. So we're back from the break. We're back from the break. Okay, great. Thank you. I'm sorry. We're trying to put this thing back together here. So you know, my take on it, my suggestion on this is that we need to expose all these things. We need to be on top of this stuff, and do it. We're going to take a break right now. It's 47 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program. and we'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
The polar caps are melting at a rapid pace. And rising ocean levels soon could harm the human race. But they have got no proof their theories are correct. Our corporations don't get enough respect. Forest, baby.
Burn it.
Burn another little piece of Brazil. It feels so good.
Cut it.
Cut another little piece of the forest down, baby.
No need to worry, 'cause there's plenty more work.
And welcome back. Yeah, the old billionaires for Bush, they got it all figured out. Kevin in Seattle on the line. Hey, Kevin, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom, I just wanted to weigh in on that whole Democrat Party response.
Yeah.
I heard George Bush do that during his press conference yesterday, and that really annoyed me. But I believe we could simply refer to the Republican Party as the Bush Party.
Well, you could, and you could argue that Bush Sr. was actually running the show when Reagan was president.
More specifically, the George W. Bush Party, because, you know, all these Republicans are trying to run away from him to get reelected, so we need to stick them to him.
Yeah, in fact, there's a guy running for Congress, running for Darlene Hooley's seat. She's my representative, and she's a Democrat here in the Portland area. And the Republican who's running against her does not have the word Republican anywhere on his website. It's incredible. It's just like not anywhere on his website. I'm looking at this. You know, one of our neighbors has a sign for the guy out there. This is how I knew he was running. And so I looked at his website, and I'm trying to figure out, what is the guy, a libertarian? Is he a constitutional party? No, it turns out he's the official candidate of the Republican Party here in the Portland area running against Darlene Hooley. It doesn't use the word Republican on his website.
I think that they use that Democrat Party as a pejorative, and I think that by using, Bush, everyone recognizes, even the Republicans, that Bush is a bad thing. So I think we should stick him with that.
There you go. Well, it's a good one. Kevin, thank you very much. Jim in Seattle. Hey, Jim.
Hi, Tom.
Jim?
It was good to see you up here in Seattle a couple weeks ago.
Oh, well, thank you.
McDermott.
Yeah, there was a group being up there with Bill Clinton and Jim McDermott. Good guys. Especially
like
Jim McDermott.
I'd like to suggest the phrase dine and dash Republican.
Dine and dash, like people who eat and run off without paying their checks in a restaurant?
Right. They're sticking someone else with the check every time.
Right. Well, good point. They're certainly sticking us all with checks.
They'll be out of office, and somebody else will have to clean up their mess.
Right. So. Yeah, a good one. Jim, thank you very much for the call. That's a good one. Here's, by the way, this is another one of, I was playing some of our listener line. This is one about Richard Reid. I was going off yesterday about it. You know, we were talking about profiling, and I said, well, what about Richard Reid? He doesn't look, Muslim.
Hi, I was listening to Tom Hartman and talking about Richard Reid, the shoe bomber. He was not white Anglo-Saxon. He was Jamaican. His father was Jamaican and his mother was British, and I don't know why people can't seem to get that through their heads. He's not white Anglo-Saxon. He is black. Bye.
Okay, thank you. Well, I looked at a picture of him, and I wouldn't have known that from the picture. And does that? But let's assume that that's the case, that he would refer to himself, and I don't know how he would refer to himself, but that he would refer to himself as Jamaican or half Jamaican or black or whatever. Does that mean we should start profiling all people with any African ancestry or Jamaican ancestry? Somehow I doubt it. Bill in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, you have an idea here, Bill. Hello? Yeah, he's there. No, Bill. Okay. Ann in Eugene, Oregon. Hey, Ann.
Hi. I wanted to remind you that Bush has already admitted to making a connection between 9/11 and Iraq. He said he never...
Yep. We lost Ann right in mid-sentence. Sorry about that, Ann. I'm showing you're still on the board, but it appears you vanished. Anyhow, tomorrow I'll be challenging conservative Fran Smith about sugar subsidies and why we should be very alarmed about this topic. Jeffrey Feldman will be here with the frame, Allen tanking over Macaca. That and more in your calls right here on the Tom Hartman radio program. And remember, my friends, activism begins with you. Democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.